Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, dancers, writers, musicians, athletes, comics, you name it. Folks who are center stage, backstage, on camera, or behind the scenes. Sit back and listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome again to the Rising from the Ashes edition of Foul Players Radio. My name is Michael Spedden. Tonight's guest, please welcome actor, director, and playwright Ted Lang to Foul Players Radio. Ted has a long and distinguished career as an actor, director, and playwright in theater, television, and movies. We talked about his many career highlights, his plays based on Black history, such as George Washington's Boy, his role as Hoke in the stage production of Driving Miss Daisy, that was directed by Charles Nelson Reilly and performed on the road and at the Jupiter Theater in Florida, performing in Hair, in theater in the 1970s, his training at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England, his current projects such as Satchmo at the Waldorf and Shakespeare Over My Shoulder, his love of Shakespearean plays, and of course some stories about performing as Isaac Washington on the Love Boat. Subscribe for free at www.foulplayersradio.com or listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, Overcast, Castro, Castbox, or Podfriend. Also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Foul Players of Perryville are now booking murder mystery shows for the late summer and fall of 2021. Indoor or outdoor venues, trains, boats, office parties, fundraisers, galas, or just for the heck of it, give us a call, 443-600-0446, or www.foulplayersofperryville.com, or email us at foulplayersperryville@yahoo.com. We'll be back with Ted Lang right after these words.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Chris Rastalli of Breaking the Fourth Wall. If you enjoy our show, you can find it on YouTube. Just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment, or just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment on Anchor.fm, Apple iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, or wherever quality podcasts can be heard. And also, you can find us on all the social medias. Just look for Realm of the Mist Entertainment, and I will catch you on the other side.
I'm Michael, the host of the semi-monthly podcast, In a City Like Yours. Join me as I chat with interesting people with interesting life stories. You can listen to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can follow us on Twitter at IACLYS Podcast, as well as on Facebook and Instagram at In a City Like Yours Podcast. Please feel free to let me know what you think, and keep coming back for the many interesting stories in a city like yours.
Hey, this is Don Smith from the Life Radio Show. If you've always wanted to learn more about the world of low-budget filmmaking and even lower-budget comedy, tune into the Life Radio Show. You can live stream the show at WWSU1069.org on Tuesdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, or find us wherever you find podcasts and like and follow the Life Radio Show on Facebook for live video and other shenanigans.
Hey, what's up? This is Chris Rastalli of Realm of the Mist Entertainment. The podcast you are listening to is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com. That's s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and information on those shows, as well as information and ability to contact publicist Steve Joyner for more information. Just go to the website and check out the family. Ladies and gentlemen, until then, enjoy the show.
Ted Lang, it's a pleasure to have you on Foul Players Radio today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good to be here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I was looking on your IMDb page, and I tell you, you are just a creative person, and you seem like you've just been going nonstop forever.
I want to stay in show business. That's the real key right there. I want to stay in show business, and sometimes you have to be flexible.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it looks like you've got a couple of projects that are either in maybe post-production and on their way out or just coming out. Are you at liberty to discuss any of those?
I just directed a show called Satchmo at the Waldorf. Mm-hmm. It stars an actor named L. Peter Callender, and he's a marvelous guy. Satchmo at the Waldorf is about Louis Armstrong, the famous trumpet player.
Oh, sure.
And there are two other characters besides Satchmo. It's a one-man show. So you've got Miles Davis is in it, and also Satchmo's manager, Joe Glazer. And wow. Peter does all of the characters. He's a brilliant, brilliant actor. Mm-hmm. And we start on February 19th. They're going to show it, streaming it on americanstage.org.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
It runs to the 28th of February.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations. Yeah. I bet you're very excited about that.
Oh, man, I'm telling you. It turned out really well. It turned out really well. And Peter's just a wonderful, wonderful actor to work with. And we did it because of technology. I'm mm-hmm. here in Los Angeles, just mm-hmm. like you're in Maryland.
Yes.
And the show I directed, he was in Florida at mm-hmm. St. Petersburg, Florida, at a theater there. And we did it. I did it through film, through Zoom. Just amazing what you can do now.
It really is amazing the things that you can do nowadays. And a lot of people have been kind of adapting themselves. As you said, you know, if you want to stay in show business, you have to adapt. A number of people that I know that have had theater companies have been doing shows over Zoom and have been kind of adopting the old radio show genre.
Yeah.
Create some shows and at least just get something out there. I've been doing a lot of podcasting myself. As an actor, you got to keep rolling. You got to stay relevant and keep up your chops and everything. If not, you get rusty, you kind of end off by the wayside. So I was looking, and one thing I wanted to talk to you about, you've written a number of plays, and a lot of Black history is in those. And one of them I just read recently, which I really enjoyed, called George Washington's Boy.
Yes. Absolutely. Sure.
So I found it very interesting. There's a lot of things that I learned in it just about a sign of the, what the times were really like back then. And you had done a boatload of research. I was looking at in the book, and good Lord, so many footnotes and so many sources and things that you really went to do your homework for this. So tell us what this experience was like.
Well, I call myself a footnote historian because most of the times when you're dealing with historical figures that are Black or African American,
sure.
they're usually a footnote. They're not, they're not writing biographies about William Lee, who was George Washington's favorite slave. So what I do is I then collect all of these books and get all the information, and then I distill it into a dramatic form so I can write a play about it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did with George Washington's Boy. Hmm. It's very fascinating because you have to sometimes read between the lines.
Yes.
For instance, one of the writers, I think it was David McCullough, called William Lee his body servant.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to say slave, No, but he was a slave,
Right.
We called him a body servant because William Lee took care of him physically. He shaved him, cut his hair, dressed him. Every day of the American Revolution, when Washington went into battle, he carried the spyglass for Washington. Mm-hmm. So, you want to put it in the time frame, but at the same time, don't erase anything, but acknowledge it.
And that was
part of my deal was to acknowledge the situation, give you an overview of what was going on at that time and the interpersonal relationship between master and slave and how they dealt with, particularly how slaves deal with their particular predicament.
Right. I thought it was very interesting how George Washington was teaching them to read. And apparently that was very, very, taboo back then.
It was a no-no. It was a big no-no.
Right.
But that was how much Washington trusted him. And remember this, mm-hmm. that William Lee used to shave George Washington.
Sure. Okay. So, yeah.
People brush by that. No. He had a razor to mm-hmm. George Washington's throat, and he could have, you know, anytime he wanted to, you know, mm-hmm. take him out. But that's not what it was. That's not what it was about. I even have a scene in the play where he's shaving him and questioning him about being free, mm-hmm. which is a wonderful irony. And if your listeners want to read the play, they can find it on Amazon. I've got about a half dozen plays up on Amazon, one George Washington Boy, and also there's a trilogy of plays called Footnote Historians Trilogy, which that's in, and I got two other historical plays that feature African Americans. One is John Brown and Harper's Ferry, and the other is called Lady Patriot, and that one deals with Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, and he had taken in a slave girl who turned out to be a spy for the Union Army.
Hmm.
The great thing about that was, of course, he had no idea she could read and write.
Mm-hmm.
And she was sending messages back to the Union side on what was going on, because she'd be right in the room with the generals and everybody else while they're plotting their plans, you know?
Right. Anyway, right.
So that's kind of what I do, Mike, is I like historical things.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't just limited myself to African-Americans. I also got a play on YouTube about William Shakespeare.
Okay. Okay.
Called right, Shakespeare right. Over My Shoulder. And mm-hmm. what you do is if you go to YouTube, type in my name, then type in the title of the play, Shakespeare Over My Shoulder. I historically, again, doing what I usually do for African-Americans, I do for William Shakespeare. I put him in context of mm-hmm. the times.
Right, so that, right, right.
Yeah, so that you learn about Shakespeare, but while you're learning about Shakespeare, you're also learning about the 1500s. 1593, mm-hmm. they had a pandemic in England, the Black Plague, and I write about that, and then I go into the plays that Shakespeare wrote at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big controversy around whether or not Shakespeare, William Shakespeare, actually wrote all the plays. Some people feel that he didn't write the plays. So I did a lot of research on that. And the four figures of that time who pop up as the possible writers of the Shakespearean play are William Shakespeare, of course, Christopher Marlowe, Francis Bacon, and Edward de Vere. So I put them all in a tavern together, and I kind of hashed it out as to who did what. But it's all research now. I want you to know it's all research, so that I'm not putting any falsehoods as far as making up stuff as much as I am distilling what was written about mm-hmm. each one of these guys and then meshing it into a story that I can give to you.
That's really neat. I'll have to check that out. I'll definitely have to check that out.
Yeah.
I noticed too in your credits that you directed or you were in a movie version of Othello.
Yes, I directed this. First I went over to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And on the recommendation of Lynn Redgrave, if you don't know who Lynn Redgrave is, just Google it. Yeah, yeah. She did a Love Boat, and we started talking about Shakespeare, and I was aficionado, and so we were exchanging lines. And so she told me, you should go over here to Rada and do, and I actually did. And one of the first things they did was they gave me Othello to read, mm-hmm. and the scenes that I worked on were from the play Othello, and I just fell in love with the character, the situation, and the story. So when I got back to America a couple of years later, mm-hmm. I did a production of Othello, and then I was able to get some money, and I made a film version of it, and took it to the Cannes Film Festival, and sent it out around the country for people to see. So that was a lot of fun.
I bet it was. What was your routine like when you were studying overseas? It was at the Royal Dramatic Arts,
Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts,
right? Okay. What was the routine like while you were there? I mean, I guess you were probably fully immersed in studying the whole time.
Absolutely. They would assign you different parts. Mm-hmm. So they assigned me Othello. I wanted to do Richard III, but they said, first do Othello, then we'll let you do Richard III. I said, okay, fair enough. And so what you would do is you'd go and you'd study the play itself. You'd study voice. You'd study movement.
Yes.
And yeah, so it was all encompassing. So they wanted you to get a hold of your acting tool, mm-hmm. which is your physical self, and then hone in on voice as well as movement, as well as emotional mm-hmm. connection of the character, you know? So mm-hmm. yeah, we did that. It was fantastic. I had some wonderful actors in the class with me. And it was a wonderful interchange of ideas and stuff. And this is what I learned, Mike. In America, we work from the inside out. In other words, we're trying to feel it and, you know, and figure out, you know, how to get that emotion into the character. Whereas they work from the outside in.
Okay.
And their whole thing is, for instance, you walk into the room and they told me, they would say, Theodore, you're really Puck. The way you enter the room, because you walk on the balls of your feet and you've got quick movements. You're really, if we cast you as Puck, there would be no problem. We mm-hmm. want you to have the discipline to be a Moorish general. So therefore, we want you to walk on the back of your heels. We want the movements to be slower and to be more deliberate. And so what you're doing is you're getting the physicality and then you're connecting to emotion. Whereas we in America connect to emotion first, then the physicality, you know? And sometimes we just eliminate physicality altogether and not do it. Like I went and saw some Americans that were doing Shakespeare and I said, well, the guy's not moving like a king, you know? But he had connected to the emotion of the speech that he was doing or the dialogue, but he wasn't kingly.
Wow. You know? Okay.
Yeah. So the benefit that I got is I learned how to bridge mm-hmm. both of those from my American training and then from my English training.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was in Othello in Washington, D.C. about 7 years ago. I played the Duke of Venice.
Oh, great.
It was a small part. And
I know the part.
It was a small part. And I got involved in this theater company from doing some community theater up in Baltimore. And they asked me to come down and audition for this part. Leading up to this, up until about 11 years ago, I'd been a local band guy. I played in local and regional bands for the past 25 years. Never acted at all. And I got this part and they were teaching me a lot of things. A lot of these mm-hmm. folks were graduates of the Ithaca theater program.
Okay.
And I know, you know, an Ithaca grad.
Who?
From Captain Steubing from the Love Boat.
Oh, gosh. Gavin McLeod. Yes. Gavin McLeod. Sure.
And I tell you that program, I mean, I was so impressed with these young people. I mean,
you went way back on that one, Gavin. Yeah. I thought you were talking about like 10 years ago, son. You went way back. Right. Yeah. Gavin, sure.
That was welcome to the pros, I tell you, when you are dealing with folks with that kind of a background. But I learned a lot of those things about stage movement and presence. And, you know, and again, like you had said, you know, you don't get rusty. You're an actor. You keep moving. You learn all these things. You know, how to be kingly is very important if you're going to be the king. You just can't go lumbering out on stage like,
yeah, like a lumberjack.
Or something
lumbering
like that.
Out like a lumberjack, yeah. Or or a motorcycle guy, you know. No, you got to.
Exactly.
They teach you, mm-hmm. you know. It's almost like ballet when you're being the king, you know. I mean, they're teaching you how to be erect, how to, you know, mm-hmm. And how to walk with authority.
Right.
Because everyone else is your minions, you know. So, yeah. You have to do that. You have to be a gentleman, so to speak, you know?
Just and I'm walking out.
Come
on, you know?
And I would guess, too, that they were probably very, and especially with you being American, they were probably very strong on your diction.
Yes. Consonants, you know, because sometimes we drop consonants. Although mm-hmm. my teacher had a guy named David Perry, and David Perry used to say that the American accent is probably closest to what the English really spoke at that time.
I've heard that too, because there were people when we were doing this production that were speaking their lines with a British accent. The director was like, no, that's not how they spoke at that time. It was a lot different.
Yeah. They did well, and if you there was a guy, what's the guy's name? Robert Easton. Robert Easton was a dialect coach, and I worked with him one time because I had the possibility of doing a movie, and I needed to have an accent, and Robert Easton was the guy, and he told me an interesting story. He said that in the hills of Tennessee, that they would find plates that came over from England. And because these guys came over from England, moved to Tennessee, and then went up into the mountains and didn't come down, they kept their isolation, kept them more in tune with how the English spoke back at that time. And the songs that they had learned were English songs. So there's a little bit of a Southern twang to what the English used to talk like, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? And that, so what they would do is the because it was a port city, London and all that, that, you know, it was on the ocean, that them being there evolved the language. You know, so that what they spoke like in the 1590s and what they speak like now has evolved to that with the English accent and the, you know, the class distinction and all of that. But that was fascinating to me. He said, yeah, they found metal plates or tin plates or pewter. And they dated back to the 1500s in England. That people had brought over, moved to Tennessee and went up into the hills, man. Amazing. Yeah.
Very interesting. It's amazing the things you learn when you really study theater and you study, I mean, there's just so many things that really go in depth that you learn. It's fascinating. And, you know, so I wanted to ask a little bit more about, you know, you had talked about what is it like for you as a playwright? I was reading in the George Washington's Boy, the book version that I got, I was reading about, you know, how, you know, the plays opened and you had a couple of notes in there about the cast and some other things. First of all, what was it like, you know, seeing, how satisfying was it for you to see your characters come to life and to see your story being told and the audience's reaction to it?
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing feeling, particularly when you find an actor that is on the same. I had a guy named Adam Clark playing Willie and Gordon Goodman, who did Washington. And these two actors had a camaraderie. Willie sitting in the audience and you're hearing the dialogue and the audience is getting it. It means you did it right. Do you know what I mean? And so that is delightful. Or if they have a monologue or a speech that they do and they capture that audience or the jokes play. Night after night, different audience after different audience, the humor of the play still comes through. So that's why you find, like, I did a thing with Sagos's. He played Hercules in my play. Hercules was the cook, and he's really a comic figure in George Washington's Boy. And Ken Sagos is really a wonderful comedic actor. But I was doing a serious play about Harper's Ferry and John Brown, and I was losing an actor. So I went to Ken Sagos and I said, hey, I want you to play this part. He said, okay. And he reads the part because he said, Ted, I can't do this. I said, what do you mean you can't do this? He said, this isn't comedy. This is drama. I know, but I believe in you. And he says, no one ever cast me in a drama. He said, I don't know if I can do it. I said, well, first of all, Kenny, I'm going to be guiding you. If you trust me, I trust you. You have to trust me to get you there. And Mike, when I tell you, this guy had a speech at the end of the play that was so dramatic, and he clicked into it. He found the heart of those words. He was fabulous. And he couldn't believe it himself. Wow. You know, he couldn't believe that he found the drama of the speech, and it changed him as an artist. You know, so now he doesn't, if someone says I got a drama, he won't back away from it. Now he goes towards it. And that's the joy of being a writer and being a director. Because I knew he had it in him, but he didn't know he had it in him. Mm-hmm. And so then when you guide an actor, and that's kind of what a director does, is the director looks for the characterization inside of you, mm-hmm. and then guides you to that path. So that what happens is you start, the choices that you start to make are right on the money. Mm-hmm. And what I say to my actors when I'm directing is, I said, I'm going to talk a lot, mm-hmm. because I want you to get on the same page with me. And once you're on the same page, I won't have to tell you not to do that, because you're going to know. You're going to stop it before it comes in, and you're going to make a choice that is right for your character. Mm-hmm. And that's why directing is, some people don't, they think it's just moving bodies. It's not just moving bodies around on a stage.
Oh, not at all.
No, man, no. This is an art form. Directing is just as much an art form, mm-hmm. as is acting.
It is.
You know? And you got to see when you're looking at an actor, sometimes you walk over to an actor and you can put your hand on his shoulder and talk to him. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can't. And the art of the director is knowing how to communicate to that actor so that he centers in on characterization. Mm-hmm. And that's what my job is. So I have to watch you, and I have to know when to push you and when to let up on you. Mm-hmm. You know, I once was doing a Love Boat, and a very beautiful actress came up to me. I was directing the scene, and she said, you know, script says I have to cry, and I can't cry. I can't do that. I can do the same. I said, listen, did I ask you to cry? And she goes, no. I said, then don't worry about it. However, what I do want you to do is mean everything that you say to this guy in the scene. If you mean what you say, you don't have to cry. And this girl got into the scene, and Mike, she bawled like a baby. Because I took the pressure off of her. Sure, she didn't have to cry. Once she knew she didn't have to cry, that all she had to do was mean what I say, mm-hmm. to this other person in the scene. The emotion of the words welled up in her, and she cried like a baby. Wow. So that's part of the art form of being a director, is knowing how to do that and having the ability to touch craftsmanship of an actor so, mm-hmm. that they can find what they need to find.
Interesting. Did you study directing when you were overseas as well?
No, you know, it's kind of like osmosis. I did the musical Hair, and I went to the—
Is that director. Right?
yeah, I did it. This is back in the 70s.
Oh, sure.
Late 60s, 69. I auditioned in 69 and then traveled. I got into the tour of, mm-hmm. the musical Hair, and I went to Tom O'Horgan, who was the director, and I said, you know, I want you to teach me how to direct. Mm-hmm. And he says, Ted, I can't teach you how to direct. There's nothing I can say. Just watch. just pay attention, you know. And I said, but aren't there certain things? Aren't there tricks? He says, Ted, I can't tell you how to direct. I can't teach you that. Mm-hmm. Just watch.
Right.
And that was the best advice I ever got, because you know when a director is good, mm-hmm. and you know when a director is not good.
Sure.
And
sure.
When you see a director that's not good, you make a note. Oh, I'll never do that to an actor, mm-hmm. you know, or Jesus, he really didn't do his homework, or he's not prepared today, or you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I started collecting the good habits of good directors that I worked with, and I stayed away from the bad habits that I've watched other directors. I'll give you an example. Sometimes when I'm directing television, I had a director that's a friend of mine. He said, I was doing West Wing, and this guy, Richard, whenever I tell him I need him to sit here and say the line from the desk, he would go, no, I want to stand by the doorway. And so then I would say, hey, I need you to stand by the doorway in this next scene. And he'd go, no, I want to sit at the desk. And so he said, the best way that I could get him to do what I want was tell him the opposite of what I needed. You know? Mm-hmm. Now, because you, first of all, you go on to a series that's been running a while, you're a guest in the room, you know? Mm-hmm. You're a guest. But I found a real simple thing to do when you're directing an actor that's been on a long-running series. Mm-hmm. You go, you sit down with him, you say, would your character sit at the desk or would your character stand by the doorway? Then the actor makes the decision. Mm-hmm. I'm the director. I can put the camera wherever I want.
Sure, sure.
You know, the camera can move, you know? So if the guy says, well, I feel that this, he would do this scene at the desk. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do my homework the night before and say he must be in this position. Mm-hmm. No, I am going to do that homework, but I'm going to be able to make adjustments, you know? Hmm. But for instance, I'll give you another example. Satchmo at the Waldorf. I'm working with this actor, Peter Callender. And I say, hey, Peter, I want you to hold a picture of Louis's mother as you do this speech. He goes, no, Ted, he wouldn't do that. I said, well, what would he do? He said, he would do this. And he explained to me what he felt the character would do. I said, oh, that's good. Okay. He says, and you know this other scene that we're going to do later today? I go, yeah. He said, I would hold the picture then because I'm really talking about all of the things my mama gave me. And I said, that's fantastic, but that's collaboration. And that's me listening to the actor and trusting the talent of the actor. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to do when I'm a director, is I come in with my own ideas. I'm not saying that I don't do the homework. I come in with my own ideas. And my idea on this was, in this scene, he talks to a picture of his mama. But the actor had the better idea. Mm-hmm. And it's about getting the best idea. So when he said, no, what about this? And then I looked at it and I reread it. And I said, you're absolutely right. Let's do that. And that's, to me, that's part of the talent of directing, is your ability to draw the best out of people and your flexibility. Because in that particular thing, I had two cameras. I could go wherever I wanted, you know. And that's what we did.
Right. You had worked at the Jupiter Theater in Florida. And what was that experience like? Because I guess you know what I'm going to ask you about, too, is the play Driving Miss Daisy. Yeah. You performed down there as the character of Hoke. And in that show, what was that experience like for you working down there?
Oh, I loved it. You know, that Charles Nelson Reilly directed the first tour of Driving Miss Daisy.
Okay.
And down in Jupiter is the Burt Reynolds Theater. Mm-hmm. And so we were on the road and we toured. We went from the northwestern side of Florida all the way down the west side of Florida, around the Horn, and then up along the eastern coast of Florida. And when we got to Jupiter, Charles Nelson Rice asked us, the cast, there were three of us. There was Daisy, Hoke the driver, and Bully, her son. Mm-hmm. There's three characters in the play. And Charles Nelson Rice said, would you do this play for my students at Burt Reynolds Theater? Mm-hmm. And we said, we love Charles Nelson Reilly. We would do anything for Charles Nelson Reilly. We said, absolutely, Charles. And so they came up to the hotel that we were staying in. We went into one of the ballrooms, and with just a couple of chairs and a few props here and there, we did Driving Miss Daisy for them. Hmm. Burt Reynolds Theater. Okay. Fade out, Mike. It's about 3 or 4 years later. I'm in Los Angeles. I need a job badly. And I bump into a casting director that I knew at a restaurant. And she said, I said, hey, Renee, how you doing? She said, I'm working for Burt Reynolds. Why don't you come by?
I said, oh, no, I don't know. And so she said, no, come by. Here's the number. I expect to see you at this time on, Friday or something. I said, okay. So I go by and I see her. And we sit and we chat. And she said, how's it going? I said, it's pretty rough right now. I'm not getting any acting gigs. And it's, I'm running around and, it's kind of tough. And so she said, well, let's go see Bert. So we go in and we see Bert. And I took my sons with me because I had I explained it. I have to pick up my sons from school. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, bring them on over. And, that's all right. So Bert Reynolds came over to me and he puts his hand on my shoulder and he looks at my sons and says, your dad is a great actor. Now, if he didn't do nothing else for me in life, he just told my two kids who go, oh, dad, this, oh, dad, that. He right. told them that I was a great actor. And so he said, listen, I know what you did for my students mm-hmm. when you did Daisy. You didn't have to do that. And you performed at the ballroom at such and such a hotel. He said, thank you so much for doing that. I said, oh, no, it was our pleasure. We the students were very receptive, and we love Charles Nelson Reilly. And so Renee, who is now the president of Burt Reynolds Productions or whatever, she says, well, Burt, he was doing Evening Shade at the time. Mm-hmm. She says, Burt, why don't you have him on the show? And so he looks at me and he goes, would you do my show? And I go, yeah. Mm-hmm. Evening Shade, are you kidding me? Certainly, I'll do your show. Absolutely. So he says, okay, we'll make arrangements. And so sure enough, I get a script and I go in and I get it late and I don't know that what they're doing is I'm a teacher for one of the characters on the show. And it's Michael Jeter. Now, Michael Jeter is about my age at the mm-hmm. time. So I don't, but as I'm reading, I'm realizing that the character that I'm playing is the same age as the driver in Daisy. Mm-hmm. And so what he's done is he's fashioned the script to go to my abilities that the kids told him about because he never saw me do Hulk Colburn in Florida. Mm-hmm. So I then realized these are all the things I have to do mm-hmm. in order to do this character on Evening Shade. So I tell him, I said, look, I need my pants done this way. I need a sweater. And I do all of the stuff, the accoutrement for being an elderly man. Mm-hmm. And then I said, do you have a fedora or something? They go, no. I said, well, don't worry. I got one. And I brought my Daisy hat.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So. Mm-hmm. We're rehearsing. Robbie Benson is directing. I don't know if you remember Robbie Benson. He was an actor.
I sure do. Robbie.
And I made the mistake of wearing Levi's. So I'm doing the physicality of an old man, but mm-hmm. Robbie can't see it. And so he's saying, oh, can you do it? But I don't have the clothes or anything. So, but the day that we do, and they wanted to fire me. Mm. They wanted to fire me after the table read, and Burt Reynolds just said no. He said, no, he's doing it. That's the guy I want.
Right, right.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And so we rehearsed all week, and then I went in and I got my costume. I put my costume on, and then we went for a camera rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And I sat down next to Michael Jeter, mm-hmm. and he looks at me. Now I look elderly. I got all of the old clothes on and I had my beard out and the beard was white. And he mm-hmm. looks at me and he looks at my head and he goes, it's the hat. And I went, I said, yeah, it is, isn't it? Anyway, we had a great, great run. And so that's how I got to do Evening Shade was mm-hmm. because I did Driving Miss Daisy for Burt Reynolds Theater in Jupiter, Florida.
That's wonderful. Well, that opened doors for you and everything. Could you elaborate a little bit more on Charles Nelson Reilly? He was really, I've read a lot about him, and he was really a talented person. I mean, most of America saw him on things like Match Game and the game shows. They saw that side of him, but he was really an accomplished actor and also, you know, producing things like operas and really just, you know, a real talent and Julie outside Harris, of that whole.
Yeah. Julie Harris thing. Had a one woman show, and he was great friends with Julie Harris. He was great friends with Uta Hagen.
Yes.
And he was a wonderful acting teacher, and he understood characterization so well that when I was doing Hulk, he was giving me all of these things to help the character. He was very, very perceptive in that way, in that he, from an acting standpoint, he knew how to bridge a gap for actors to find character. That's what one of his strengths was. But the other thing is this, he was always late.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was always late. He'd come in a half hour late. And then when he came in a half hour late, the Daisy that I had was a woman named Rosemary Prince. She was a fabulous actress, and she and I had a really great chemistry. And we liked to rehearse. But Charles would come in late, and he'd sit down, and he said, "Let me tell you what happened to me today." And he spent a half hour explaining the half hour. And so we were like, "Charles, we want to rehearse." He says, "No, but listen to this." You know, I'll give you a great story that he told us, because he was great friends with Uta Hagen. Mm-hmm. Uta Hagen, if you ever look her up on, if you Google her name, she did Desdemona to Paul Robeson's Othello.
Yes.
Okay, and Jose Ferrer was Iago.
And she was involved with the Actors Studio, the method acting. Right.
And so one time, he was telling the story. He was late, and he was talking about Uta Hagen and Geraldine Page. Now, some of these names your listeners are going to have to Google, but Geraldine Page was an extraordinary actress. Uta Hagen wrote a book called Respect for Acting. Okay, which is for a lot of actors, that's one of their main books, is Respect for Acting. And she had written some cookbooks, you know? And so he was relating this story that Uta Hagen had told Charles, that she was at a party. She met Geraldine Page, and Geraldine Page came up to her and said, "Listen, I want to thank you so much for your book. Your book saved my life. It was really, really well written and wonderful." And Uta Hagen says, "Oh my goodness, you, the great Geraldine Page, read my book, Respect for Acting?" And she said, "No, you can't tell me anything about acting. I'm talking about your cookbook. I'm having a dinner party, and I needed to serve some, and I used your cookbook. You, girl, I know about acting. What are you talking about? Can't tell me anything about acting." So anyway, he was full of wonderful stories like that.
Oh, great. Yeah. Great. That's awesome. That's excellent. You know, he was such a great talent and did so many great things, again, that people, you know, may not have known about because of his, you know, the big, you know, boisterous character that he was on all the game shows.
Hollywood Squares too, I think, Match Game. But he also did the TV series of The Ghost and Mrs. Muir.
Right.
He was on that also with Hope Lang.
And
Hope Lang did a Love Boat. And so we would tease each other because we spell our names the same way, you know? So she says, "You know, I have a brother. I've never met him." And I said, "Sis, yes, you have."
Right.
You know, but yeah, it was fun. We had a lot of fun on the show.
That's wonderful. I wanted to ask a little bit more about some of your television shows that you've done over the years. And I was just looking through your credits and trying to find some, you know, interesting questions to ask you. And I saw that you had done a show, and we'll get to some Love Boat questions in a minute here, but you did a show called Mr. T and Tina. It looked like it was a short series in around 76.
Four episodes aired, Mike. Only four.
Okay.
And we shot eight.
Okay.
And it was Pat Morita.
Yes.
Or Karate Kid.
Right. That was probably maybe in between Happy Days stints with him.
Well, he left Happy Days to do Mr. T and Tina.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so he was probably okay. That, because they brought him back later on.
Yeah, yeah. He left to do Mr. T and Tina. It was going to be a Japanese situation comedy. Mm-hmm. And we had the I Love Lucy writers.
Okay, okay.
Bob Carroll Jr. and Madeline. I forget Madeline's last name. Anyway, Madeline, they... It was about Japanese culture, kind of like a fish out of water in Chicago.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, but they were fine with Chicago jokes, but they weren't so good with Japanese jokes.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because that's not their deal.
Sure.
And,
sure.
And in those days, that was in the 70s, you know, they were reluctant to hire ethnic writers.
Okay. Okay.
So you had and I know this for a fact, as a friend of mine named Bill, who was a Japanese writer, he kept saying that Pat Morita did him dirty. And I said, what do you mean? Well, he promised to get me on as a writer on when he was doing Mr. T and Tina. And I said, Bill, he tried. And I know he tried, because I was there for that. I was on the show. He goes, no, Pat didn't. I said, no, he did. And but that back at that time, you know, they weren't having it. You know, they would hire the guys they knew or the girls they knew. And that was Jimmy Komek was the executive producer.
Yes. Okay. And that just told me something here, because I was looking in the credits of that show and I saw a whole bunch of sweat hogs in the credits.
Yeah.
Did you do a crossover episode with Welcome Back, Kotter?
No, but I know all of those guys. I mean, Bobby Hedges and, of course, Lawrence Hilton Jacobs and Ron Palillo. Oh, boy, Ron Palillo.
Travolta was listed, too. Yeah.
Yeah. He, you know, after Kotter went down, Palillo, he had a lot of trouble getting work as an actor, you know? And I remember having a conversation. They did a Where Are They Now show. Okay, we're both in New York. Ron is there, I'm there, Jimmy Walker's there. But Ron was a serious actor. But you can't take show business too seriously or it'll kill you.
Sure, sure.
You know, it will kill you if you, you know, if you want to be doing Hamlet and you're in show business and they won't give you the shot, you can't take this seriously. You've got to maneuver, you know, and I remember him being a wonderful artist while we were sitting in the green room waiting to do this TV show, because it was a lot of money at the time. And particularly if you hadn't worked a lot, they say, where are they now? And you say, I'm right over here. Let me cash the check, you know. So Ron became very, very bitter because he couldn't get any work. And so the agent told him, he said, you know, Ron, the problem with your acting is your nose. You need a nose job. You get a nose job, we can get you work. So Ron got a nose job.
Okay, huh.
And after he got a nose job, he still couldn't get any work.
Oh, gosh.
He was one pissed off guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you know, you'll see on my resume that I did some writing, I did some directing, you know what I mean? I did other things. When one door closed, I went and knocked on a different door, you know? So I felt really sad about Ron, because he could have gone into art, because he was a wonderful, wonderful artist, but he would just stew about not getting acting jobs. And that'll kill you. And that's what it did. He walked around angry all of the time. So, yeah.
I had seen a special. I think they were doing something about the sweat hogs or something. And they did say that, I guess, right before it must have came out right before he died. Because I think he died around the same time that Robert Hedges died. And they were saying that he had gotten into painting. He had been a painter for a long time.
Yeah, he was amazing. Robert Hedges did a Love Boat. We went to Mexico. We're on the beach in Mexico. And some guy walks up to him and says, you're Robert Hedges. He goes, yeah. Can I shake your hand? and he shakes Robert Hedges' hand and he gives him some marijuana cigarettes. Okay? In Mexico.
Oh, wow.
All right. So Robert Hedges shakes the guy's hand. The guy goes off. Robert Hedges takes his hand and he does like this. Right? Because he don't want to have anything to do with it. Mm-mm. He said, I took about 10 steps and these police were there to grab me. Mm-hmm. And they said, where's the dope? So he had gotten set up.
Wow.
On the beach in Acapulco. They wanted to arrest him and throw him in jail.
He's a whiz.
You know, I mean, wow, what the heck is going on here, you know?
Boy, you really got to watch yourself with some of that.
You got to watch yourself, man. People, you don't know who's watching you.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah, you don't know who's watching you. So they had a guy set him up, put the marijuana in his hand, thinking he would take it and smoke it later or whatever. He
right.
On the beach and kept walking.
Jesus, you know? Whiz. So,
yeah, wow. Man.
Wow. So I was, again, looking through your IMDb page. I saw that you have... Of course, we all knew you on The Love Boat as Isaac, you know, Isaac Washington, the bartender. And it looks like you had brought that character to a couple of other series and shows. I guess it was a good number of them, too. You're not quite as high up on the numbers as Richard Belzer playing Detective Munch.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You've had it out there quite a bit here. So I guess, you know, if you would, tell us a few Love Boat stories, maybe if you have some fond memories of the show. I'm sure you had mentioned that you enjoyed working with everybody on the show.
Yeah.
Brought Bernie Capel back to be in a couple of your to be in your play George Washington's Boy. Maybe if you could just tell us about what the cast was like working with those folks and maybe some favorite stories.
Yeah, the cast was wonderful. Tweez was great. Gavin, Bernie, Fred and I, we found that if you watch the show sometimes, you'll see a lot of Go for Isaac stories. Mm-hmm. Because Fred and I had a camaraderie that was palpable, that you could see us, you know, I found him funny. He found me funny. And we would work accordingly in a scene, you know, sometimes you work with an actor and they want all the punchlines or, you know what I mean? But
sure, right,
we did a scene together and he said, I think Isaac would say this. I go, okay. And then I would say, or I think that's a gopher joke. You know, we didn't have that kind of competition going between us. Mm-hmm. I remember Tweez was absolutely wonderful. I remember I wanted to be a director because I had gone to the American Film Institute to study directing. So every year I would go to the producers and I say, can I direct an episode? They go, no, get out of here. You're Isaac. You can't direct an episode. And I said, but, I went and studied at this film school for directing. Oh, no, get out of here. If we let you direct, everybody else is going to want to direct. So then I would go to the rest of the cast. I say, do you want to direct? No. Do you want to direct? No. Do you want to direct? No. So then I go back. I say, hey, guess what? You can let me direct the show. They say, what do you mean? I said, nobody else wants to direct. Mm-hmm. They go, no, we're not letting you direct. Get out of here. So around the fourth year of the show, they had signed us to a five-year contract. Usually they sign you to a seven-year contract.
Oh,
They signed us to a five-year contract. And the fourth year of the show, we're still up in the top five. And they came to us and they didn't want to have us hold them up for a whole lot of money. So they said, we're going to renegotiate your contract and add three more years onto the contract that you have. Mm-hmm. How much money do you want? And I said, well, there's a thing called favored nations. And I said, just give me favored nations. And they go, well, no, tell us how much you want. I go, no, just whatever you give the other guys, just give me. Mm-hmm. However, I would like to direct an episode. And so they go, oh, man. All right. So we'll put you on Favorite Nations and we'll give you an episode to direct. Now, Favorite Nations means no one gets more than the other guy.
Oh, sure. Right.
Okay. That's what Favorite Nations means. So in other words, if we're talking about Happy Days and Ron Howard is Richie, everybody else makes less than Ron Howard. You can't make more than Ron Howard. You have to make less because he was the star. Mm-hmm. Now, what if Henry Winkler takes off as the Fonz? Mm-hmm. Then you give him all of this stuff and he passes Ron Howard as far as salary and perks and all of that. Well, now Ron Howard's agents are going to call you and say, you can't give him more than you give Henry. You can't give Henry more than you give Ron. So they're equal. They're always equal. And so Bernie, Fred, and myself, we were all equal. We were all on the same tier. That's what they like to say. You, Bernie, and Fred are all on the same tier. So, cool. Great. And so Bernie, we'd sit in. So I came in. What they did is they called it coming in. I came in for Favorite Nations, meaning I was going to accept whatever they gave us. And so Bernie was busy negotiating. And Bernie said, you know, I deserve more money than you guys because I'm older than you and I've been around longer than you guys. So I'm going to ask him for the moon. And I said, Bernie, I hope they give you the moon. Mm-hmm. Because if they give him the moon, they got to give me a slice of that moon. Right. You know what I'm saying? So I said, Bernie, see, hit him for all your worth. You know, get him. So anyway, so he got a nice, we all got a nice bump in salary. Mm-hmm. But they came back to me and they said, listen, you still want to direct? I go, yeah. What do you mean? Yeah, of course I do. He said, well, here's the thing we're going to do. If you want to direct, we're going to see how much you really want to direct. If you want to direct, we want you to take a little bit less than Fred and Bernie. And then when you direct your episode, we'll bring you up equal to what they have. So in other words, Ted, if you really want to direct, you're going to be working twice as hard on that episode, but you're still going to, you're not going to make more than them. You're going to make the same as them. And now, do you still want to direct? Go, yes, I still want to direct. All right. So I direct my episode, Mike. It turns out really fantastic. So every year we used to have a lunch with the executive producer, Doug Kramer. And Doug Kramer said, well, this coming year, we're going to go to the Orient. We're going to go to Hong Kong. We're going to go to Tokyo. We're going to go, you know, to the Great Wall in Beijing in China. So that's what the kind of lunch we have. Oh, this next year, we're going to have Lana Turner on the show and we're doing this. So that was kind of to give us a heads up of what was coming. Well, after I directed my show, the executive producer, Doug Kramer, says, hey, you know, we're having problems finding really good directors for our show. So Bernie and Gavin, you guys have been around a long time. If you know any directors you like, tell us about it and we'll sign them on to direct an episode and see how they work out. And speaking of directing, by the way, Ted did his episode, turned out really well. Thank you, Ted. Congratulations. Now you have one show to direct next year. Do you want to direct it in the beginning of the year, in the middle of the year, or the end of the year? And I said, well, you know, Doug, since you're having problems finding good directors, I'd like to direct one in the beginning, one in the middle, and one at the end. And Lauren Tweez goes, that's a great idea.
Hey.
So they ended up giving me the three shows instead, you know, even though you can almost see Kramer go, oh, man, why did I say this? Why did I put this in front of that? You know, but that's how we were. We were really, we really loved each other. We were really friends. And those friendships have lasted since 1978 when we went off the air.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know, it's really nice to hear that you were able to make such good friends doing this and keep in touch over the years. And, you know, you were also, you know, loyal to your friends by casting them in different things. And, it's really great to have an inner circle like that of folks that you can go to. And I'm blessed to have that myself with the folks I've worked with over the years and to the point where my career has reached and everything. So, wow. Well, this has been just a wonderful experience talking to you today, Ted.
Thank you, Mike.
Enjoyed having you on. I hope you've had a good time. This is the part of the show where we allow our guests to shamelessly plug anything that they have that they would like us to all know about as shamelessly as they would like to?
Oh, well, let me, I have a couple.
The floor is yours,
first.
My friend.
Satchmo at the Waldorf, starring L. Peter Callender. You go to americanstage.org. It's streaming February 19th through February 28th. So I promise you a wonderful, wonderful experience. If you go to YouTube, you can see my play, Shakespeare Over My Shoulder. And I've got a couple of other plays. I got The Tears of Shylock. That's also a Shakespearean themed play. And Four Queens, No Trump, and Blues in My Coffee. And Blues in My Coffee is my Black Lives Matter play. So,
okay.
And also, if you want to read the plays, they're on Amazon.
Yes, I did. And they're great. They're great. I really enjoyed reading them. And
thank you so much.
So, well, thank you so much for being with us again today, folks. This is Ted Lang on Foul Players Radio. We'll see you next time, folks. Thanks for listening.
Howdy. It's Matt Gwynn here, popping in to let you know about the Adventures of the Albino Rhino. It's a show Frank the Giraffe here, my co-host, James Godwin, and myself put on for you guys twice a week. Every Wednesday, we talk to a comedian, and every Friday, we call it Freak Yeah Friday. The show itself is not safe for work, and that freak is definitely a different word. I just don't know what podcast you're going to be listening to this promo on, and I don't want to, start screaming explicatives while you're sitting in your office, if you're lucky enough to have been able to go back to the work that you did before inside of an office or whatever, you know? But we go on an adventure twice a week, and it's a good time because we get to sit down and talk to some really cool people. And I enjoy it because, you know, I'm just curious little albino who likes to get to know folks, you know? You can find us a couple ways, actually multiple ways, really. Man, there's a lot of different ways to find us. You can find us through our central hub, which is www.albinorhino.me. It's the website. Find me on. And then, you know, the podcast, you can find the videos on YouTube. Search for Adventures of the Albino Rhino. Also linkable from our website. And you can also find us through Anchor, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Radio Public, and Spotify. That's right. We're on the same place Joe Rogan is. Granted, we're not the Joe Rogan Experience. But you know what I mean? We're there. So give us a listen. Promise you won't be dissatisfied. And enjoy your day.
What's going on, minions? Mike here for Misery Point Radio, and you're listening to the Coast to Coast Power Hour on the SJ Network. Now, I know what you're thinking. Mike, what the F is a Coast to Coast Power Hour? Well, my uneducated and uninformed friend, the Coast to Coast Power Hour is a Borg-like collective of epic podcasters from epic podcasts that have all come together to discuss the important things in life. Pop culture, current events, random awesomeness, stuff like that. Trust me, you need this in your life. For more information on this show and all the shows on the Coast to Coast Power Hour, as well as on the SJ Network, reach out to publicist Steve Joyner at www.s-j-network.com or stevesjnetwork@gmail.com. No need to thank me. I'm just out here, you know, changing lives.
What's Your Effin' Binge is a podcast brought to you by Chris, Anchor, and Spotify. And what we talk to our guests about is what they're currently binge-watching on TV. And what we do is we like to take a different approach. I don't want to know what the name of the show is that they're going to talk about before they come on. I have to actually guess it. So I ask them who, what, when, where, why, and try to figure out what it is that they're watching. A lot of times I'm able to guess it, and sometimes I'm not. And that's fine. That adds to the comedy of the show. We like to bring our guest on, whether they're a model or an actress or producer or musician, and just let them have a platform to be able to tell everybody what they have coming up next, and also entertain everybody with what's worth watching. So I hope everybody tunes in for the next episode of What's Your Effin' Binge. Thanks. It's Chris.